Rumpus time is over.
New sheriff in town.
Luke's crazy.
Did you hear that, Brian?
Luke, we're gonna have company!
Brian, bad guys of the galaxy, beware! The defender of the universe is here!
In order to form a more perfect union.
Luke! Brian!
Luke Bryan's!
One margarita, two margarita, three margarita shot.
Stop that! You're not going into a song while I'm here.
And now for something completely different.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Talking Heads.
Welcome to Dueling Tangents this lovely Friday, May 12th already. Boy, May has gone fast. It is sunny and 69 degrees. Very nice where I'm at in Germantown, Wisconsin. Ev, how's Madison looking today?
It's a beautiful day, my friend. It's a beautiful day.
Is it?
Oh, yeah. I'm here alone, by the way. You know, not to give anyone any ideas, okay? But yeah, it's so quiet over here. The Solidarity Realty Studios, pretty chill today.
I did my best to get you some nice weather so that the trip into town wasn't as problematic as usual. But
thank you, buddy.
We got a very, very exciting show today. I am so proud to introduce our expert guest, my good friend, Alan Minsky. Alan is the executive director of Progressive Democrats of America. You may have heard of them as they were the organization that first drafted Bernie Sanders to run for president back in 2013. Alan, how are you doing today on this lovely Friday afternoon?
I'm doing really good. You know, the temperature, the sunniness is all about the same where I am. I'm in Southern California, and I just was on a picket line with the Writers Guild of America, which is out on strike. And you can probably not be as entertained in the coming months in front of your screens of whatever variety screen you're watching, because these guys are incredibly talented. They work very, very hard to provide insight and entertainment for Americans and people across the world, and they are getting shafted right now. In terms of what the lords of the entertainment industry are proposing in terms of what their wages will be and their work conditions will be. So they're standing up and fighting for what's right. And it's important because this is the further gigification of another industry. And they are resisting it. And we have to stand with them and resist it as well.
That's what I like to hear, solidarity. And we'll actually jump into that topic in a little bit. I have to make the joke because I always do when Luke's not here is that, you know, Boring Uncle Luke is gone, or actually, Papa Luke will say is gone, you know, the boring, not as fun one. So the party people are here to play when it's me and Evan. So we are bringing on party guest Alan Minsky to talk about a number of different issues that are incredibly, incredibly important, I think, in the national media ecosystem right now. Particularly, as I noted too, we will start with the writer's strike. Southern California weather is obviously gorgeous for you year round. So I shouldn't have even made that reference to you because the rest of us are sitting here pretty jealous that we were just getting this. But Alan, you were down at the picket line. Tell me about the experience. Tell me about the energy. Tell me about why this strike is so important and why it's gathered national attention in comparison to some of the other labor movements that we've seen, kind of shut down, even from the Democratic Party perspective.
Well, actually, when I was out there, I talked, again, as executive director of Progressive Democrats of America, I talked to one of the, the guild people who were in charge of this particular picket line outside the Netflix office, because the California Democratic Party is going to have its convention in Los Angeles in 2 weekends. And, 3 weekends from now, but just about 15 days from now. And can we get Democratic leadership out on the picket line? You know, even in England, the current Labour Party, which has moved back to the center in recent years, were castigating members of the Labour Party for joining pickets. Well, we can't let we got to hold the Democrats' feet to the fire. All the Democratic Congress people, all the Democratic state senators and elected officials will be here in Los Angeles, and we have to demand that they come out and support the writers. If they're still on strike 2 weeks from now, and of course it looks like it will. Now, it's a funny scene out there. There's a lot of comic writers, a lot of talented writers. And, you get the picket sign and it's blank and everybody's sitting there sort of thinking about what they'll write into the picket so they can have the funniest sign. So there's a lot of funny signs, but I'll be brief because the one that I liked the most today that I saw was simply we write you wrong.
I like it.
Yeah, I messed up the punchline there, but yeah, we write you wrong. And,
but- writers are some of the most, those are quite literally the people writing the jokes for your favorite television shows. You have to imagine that they will come up with some very creative ways to get their point across. I see that joke used on Twitter all the time too, right? Is that so many of the most followed, most creative, most humorous Twitter accounts have been very pro the writer's strike. Well, why is that? Because most of these people are professional writers. There's a reason their Twitter accounts are so engaging and so entertaining, because they do that for a living. They're some of the best and brightest in the world at what they do.
Yeah, so, and I'm ready for my favorite shows to just take a giant dive here. I remember what happened the last time, right? And I'm all in support of it. They deserve a living wage at the end of the day. And I'll get a little, you know, a little Schadenfreude, as it were, to see some of these intellectual properties, just, they won't be the same. They will not be the same without the writers.
And some of the numbers are astounding. You look at, I believe it was Adam Conover went on CNN a few weeks ago and noted that executives at some of these firms are making hundreds of millions of dollars a year, more than enough to compensate every single writer with a living wage. And actually, mentioning living wage is something that we'll get into with Alan in the third segment of today's show, because that's my absolute favorite platform to discuss. But Alan, as the executive director of PDA, can you tell me about what the organization represents, your kind of role within the organization, and your role within the progressive movement at the national level? We talked about how you were at the forefront of driving Bernie Sanders' run in 2013, 14, 15, which, in my opinion, was arguably the greatest movement of my lifetime. I have my shirt on right now. I was elected as a delegate to the 2020 convention. His 2016 campaign is what motivated me and a lot of my friends as we were in college at the time to really get involved in politics. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why I have so much respect for the organization, is because you, in a way, indirectly contributed to my passion and love for politics through the efforts that you have made.
Well, I mean, you know, the 2016 presidential election was a game-changing election. It was a and I think probably more so than any election that's occurred in American presidential elections since 1980, where you had Carter leave Reagan, you had the real launch, the full-on launch of neoliberal capitalism, you know, in the United States of America, you know, following in and joining with Thatcher in England, who was elected in 79. And then the transformation of the whole global economic system towards this, you know, prioritizing the returns for the investor class as opposed to the welfare of average people. Well, in 2016, following the 2007-2008 market crash, I think American politics sort of stalled. You didn't have a political electoral response because, you know, there are sets of issues in American political history that are top line issues. And of course, one of them is structural racism. The first Black president in a glorious moment was elected in November of 2008. And in many respects, the left movements across the country didn't move into electoral politics in response to this huge, massive economic crisis that absolutely just changed millions of people's lives, left them tremendously dissatisfied. They were dissatisfied with the Obama administration's response. But the importance of reelecting the first Black president, of course, was tantamount in 2012. So you have this delay until 2016, and then you get a response. And you get a response in which basically, in the rearview mirror, you can look at the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. Oftentimes it's spoken of a foreign policy consensus that's starting to break up now. But for the whole Cold War period, the two decades that follow, you had a two-party foreign policy consensus. You rarely heard about a two-party economic consensus. But in the rearview mirror, we can see now that from 2016 and all the way through to about 1992, you had a two-party economic consensus for this idea that markets will make all the decisions about how economic life should be organized. And that broke apart and blew apart in 2016. You had a right-wing rebel candidate, a reactionary right-wing rebel candidate who had the wrong answers, and you had the left-wing progressive rebel candidate who had the right answers. Sadly, as we all know, the wrong rebel candidate won. But even Trump, you know, opposed some of the core components of the neoliberal agenda, particularly, though, only in an incremental way around trade policy. And that would be his strongest hand in his opposition. And he, of course, for the American public is something of a master communicator, and he was able to highlight those things. And his victory in Michigan, of course, was largely attributed to that kind of messaging. But again, it was a break with the neoliberal order, and Sanders was a real break and a meaningful break. And people responded to it, and they saw and they learned that we could have a better life for the average people in America simply by adopting the policies that have been in place to a much greater degree in every other prosperous industrial technological democracy in the world. And those are the other wealthiest countries in the world. And the life that is led by people in Western Europe, in countries like Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, it's those countries. People live with much less stress, much more security, better health care, better public education, basically better lives, more vacation time, they work less hours, they're less depressed, there's not a prison industrial complex, on and on and on and on. The life is better. And Sanders was able to introduce that to the American people, and particularly young Americans were like, yeah, wow. And one of the things about America, one of the ways America got that way was the American public, I think from about from World War II all the way through to this century, the awareness of how people lived in other countries wasn't that great. And so the deterioration of life here was able to be achieved to a much greater degree than in other countries. There are other components about why that took place. But the paradox is many of those countries that have those policies, the United States of America and the Roosevelt administration and the Truman administration basically set their economic agendas going forward out of World War II. But those policies held there, and they got chipped away and deteriorated, really whole cloth in the United States of America. So it's well past the time when we join the rest of the world. We have a prosperous life for all people in the society. It is attainable. It'll be a better life. It'll be a healthier society. And we, PPDA, are an organization that espouses that from here to the northern tip of Alaska, to the southern tip of Florida, out to Hawaii, and all the way up to northeast Maine. And that's who we are. We're a national grassroots up organization. Back in 2014, we were a big fish in the small pool of progressive electoral politics. But thanks to our creating the Sanders campaign, with Bernie, of course, having even more credit than we deserve, but in creating that. And what happened with PDA is our executive director died in 2014. Because of that, there was some institutional drift in the years that followed. And I came in about 2018, and we're building now momentum all across the country again. We're not so inside the Beltway focused. We are a grassroots up organization with strength and membership across the country.
Mm-hmm. And the Sanders movement really changed the game. We're going to dive even deeper into our conversation with walking encyclopedia Alan Minsky after the break.
Sorry,
into a history of progressive politics. This is Dueling Tangents. We'll see you right back. Welcome back, party people. It is Friday, May 12th. You are listening to Dueling Tangents with Luke and Brian. And if you're lucky, Will and Evan, and today, Alan. We have an excellent, excellent show planned for today. And I cannot wait to dive into the 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights, which we will jump into in the third and fourth segment. Because personally, I think that could be a similar rallying cry for the next generation of voters that Medicare for All was for Bernie Sanders. You know, we've been talking about how PDA was kind of at the forefront of the progressive movement and launching Sanders' campaign in 2013, 14, and 15. And I think when a lot of people who aren't as well-versed in politics think of Sanders and the Sanders campaign, the one topic that really resonated with them was Medicare for All, because the vast majority of Americans, young, old, right, left, understand that the health insurance and the healthcare industry in the United States is inherently corrupt and it's inherently problematic, and that it's a problem that frankly the vast majority of us face. And we recognize that a solution is not only required today, but was probably required 15 to 20 years ago. So when we dive into that topic in the third segment, I'm going to defer to Alan because he is the mastermind behind a lot of these ideas. But for now, I want to jump into, Alan, something we kind of talked about before the break, is that progressivism as a movement really differs in a lot of ways from what's considered the establishment status quo of the current Democratic Party. We represent a different platform than the mainstream party. And in a lot of ways, these platforms resonate really well with rural and small town Americans, including, you know, conservatives. My best example would be something that I have talked about on the show numerous times. The Dunn County healthcare referendum, should the United States implement a national nonprofit health insurance program, passed 51%, which means it outperformed the victorious incumbent governor by almost 16 points. This was in a very rural, very white, very conservative Wisconsin community. And I think it showcases that these ideas are not only popular with Democratic voters, but are popular with the entirety of the American electorate. Alan, could you kind of give me some comparisons, some jumping off points that you think are particularly noteworthy from the PDA platform in comparison to something that you might expect an establishment Democrat to support?
Well, of course, Medicare for All is important to note right now because it's getting reintroduced on Wednesday, this time in unison between Pramila Jayapal and Bernie Sanders in Senate, Jayapal's bill in the House. And that's on healthcare. Struggle for a living wage, support for unions. When did you ever see, you know, Bill Clinton or Barack Obama on a picket line? Mm-hmm. Let me tell you, you didn't. Okay.
And that I saw Alan on one today.
Yes, that's for sure. I was there today, but no, you're not gonna see that. And across the board, I mean, we have these endemic problems in American society and they're not addressed. They're just sort of accepted as part of the wallpaper of American society. I mean, it goes all the way out to the prison industrial complex and how that operates, the defunding of public education, the absence of any payments out for mental health care because there's a mental health crisis in the United States of America. Across the board on policy after policy, there simply is a difference between advocating for something where you maybe throw some crumbs. I mean, look at what just happened with poverty. In the pandemic relief package, there were payments made out that were made available to the public that reduced U.S. poverty in half. What moral justification is there for them pulling back those policies? Okay, should we also set out to restructure the organization of employment in our society so that people don't have to suffer poverty? We on the progressive left now, to a greater and greater degree, support a full employment program, a real full employment program at a living wage. Now, in the private marketplace, we still have a national minimum wage of $7.25. But if you had a federal job guarantee program, whatever it is, you can allow a lot of local autonomy in terms of what gets done and what the people do who are doing these jobs, right? But if it is set at a living wage or even $15 minimum wage, nobody's going to take a job doing $7.25. It creates a de facto national minimum wage. It allows people to not live in poverty. It allows people to live in dignity. Also, by the way, if you set a federal job guarantee like that and you only work 35 or 40 hours a week, as opposed to so many jobs where people find themselves working 60, 70, 80 hours a week just to get by, having two or three jobs, it would completely transform the American labor market. And that's the kind of idea that progressives support that you'll never see embraced by the moderate wing of the Democratic Party that is attentive to how Wall Street defines a healthy economy. And it has been since the Clinton administration. And when you see the difference around rural America and the rural Americans voting for the Republican Party and rejecting the Democratic Party, I actually take issue with Democrats who really hang on the idea that they're voting against their own interests. I don't think they're doing that when they're voting against the Bill Clinton Democratic Party. That party pretty much viewed all the assets of rural America as assets that could be monetized and financialized and turned into tradable assets, essentially on stock markets around the world. And the welfare of individual families, individual family farms, individuals writ large, was subordinate to how things played out as market, as numbers on market ledgers. And that is not the progressive wing of the party. We are constitutively different. And this is the thing. It goes back to Sanders versus Clinton versus Trump. Bernie Sanders took a strong third, you could look at this way, in two successive presidential cycles. And the progressive movement is simply we have a two-party system with three strong national tendencies vying for power. And the way I look at those is the reactionary Trumpian right, the neoliberal middle that runs from the Clinton wing through the Romney wing of the Republican Party, and then the progressives. It's a two-party system with three very, very distinct ways of organizing American society. And I think the progressive movement, in terms of its economic and social organization of society, is vastly superior than either of the other two for the welfare of small town and rural America. It's not even an argument, in my opinion.
And polling shows that those ideas are significantly popular across a wide spectrum of American voters. I use the Dunn County example once again because I think it perfectly encapsulates everything that you were just saying. Unfortunately, first past the post voting kind of means that you can't get this third wing will never be able to grow unless they are able to grow through one of the two parties.
And so how are we attacked? We're attacked as if we're like language Stalinists who are going to go in and shame people in rural and small town America because they're not saying the wrong thing. Okay. Now, there are people who are affiliated with the progressive left you can point to. Look, we're a country of 335 million people. But the idea of having solidarity and dignity and accepting people for who they are and where they are, talking to them about their lives and how we can help improve all of our lives together and their lives if they're looking for improvement in political and public policy, that is definitional for the progressive movement.
100%. We'll be right back after the break. We're going to jump into the Economic Bill of Rights. See you then.
Unite in the fight against Parkinson's disease in a safe but exciting and fun way. So let's get moving. Join the Parkinson's Foundation to learn more and register at movingdaywalk.org.
Welcome back, party people. Friday, May 12th. You're listening to Dueling Tangents with Luke and Brian. And because you are lucky, William Evan. And today, my guest, Alan Minsky, Executive Director of Progressive Democrats of America. Alan, something I want to touch on quick before we get to our meat and potatoes conversation that you mentioned before the break was that I think a lot of mainstream establishment Democrat type platforms really talk down. They like to punch left to the progressive platform. They like to it's a straw man argument in action. They create this entity that they think is points that we are arguing in and a world that we want to create that I think is just wholly inaccurate and does really a disservice to the movement that's trying to generate solidarity amongst working class Americans throughout the country. Could you touch on a couple examples that you noted earlier that I think really hit home?
Well, I mean, first of all, the huge divide that exists between the Republican camp and the Democratic camp, this idea that there's this almost civil war like ending because the divide is so deep and so severe. And I don't want to downplay that in rural and small town America, and we work very closely, we're developing with a group of people a 21st century rural New Deal proposal. And the people we're working with have done a lot of work in rural America. And they very much were aware that in 2016 in particular, you had the phenomenon of the Trump Sanders supporter. Like, I like Bernie, but I'm going to like Trump rather than Clinton. Or I like Trump, but you know, I really also like was Bernie Sanders. Okay. So there's obviously something there. And look, there is no doubt there is a certain percentage of the population who are unreachable. Over the past 10 to 20 years, there has been a rise, going back to the mid 90s, even of a kind of proto-fascist far right, very militarized kind of a proto-fascist approach to politics. We all know about it. They get a ton of headlines. How large a portion of the Republican base that represents, I tend to think it's exaggerated in the press. I think it's real. It exists. We're not going to be converting those folks into progressives, okay? There are people whose language of contempt and racism is beyond the pale. But for the most part, I think most of the people across the country, they do not in their hearts think of themselves as racist. And the way that they're painted that way, I think comes as much from the kind of contempt and punching down you see from very elite Democrats, ones who host late night talk shows, for instance, right? And they really have a free float. I mean, the sense that coastal elites have contempt for middle Americans, it's not, the progressive base that has access to those platforms, okay? That, in fact, is itself largely coming from the moderate wing and the well-off wing, the neoliberal wing of the Democratic Party.
And it alienates millions of voters immediately, regardless of what positions you're arguing for or against.
Right. And I just challenge anybody listening, when have you ever seen Bernie Sanders do that? And I will hate myself if in any way I ever come across that way. Okay. Now, I know that I probably fit in many respects the profile of a coastal elite, but I grew up in Missouri and my heart is with the working class and working people wherever they reside. And I have full-on respect for them. And if you look at the progressive left and you look at an idea of free speech, you see the progressive left being castigated for being opposed to free speech by platforms like Ben Shapiro and Tucker Carlson. Absolutely untrue. I mean, the progressive left are the adamant defenders of American free speech and the First Amendment. They've been for decades, and they remain so to this day. So, it's a way of trying to have people dismiss the progressive left and not take seriously what really is our primary product, as it were, or what we want to deliver to the American people, which is a more benign and social and economic organization. It's not utopian. It existed in the United States coming out of the Roosevelt administration for decades after that, albeit not distributed fairly to the entire population because of the legacies of structural racism. But it exists in countries around the world, and it can function here, and it'll make people's lives better. That's our primary product. And it is not in any way shaming people, castigating people about this or that instance of language use. In fact, quite the contrary. We have to be a movement of solidarity and inclusivity and welcoming to all people.
I see that online a lot. They kind of, it's the threat of, you know, cancel culture. You'll get canceled if you say the wrong thing. And then they point to examples of massive multinational corporate conglomerates who have been the ones doing the quote unquote canceling. Absolutely. And I'm like, what, in what way, shape or form is, you know, Coca-Cola progressive? They've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on market research where they've determined that these ideas are popular. And if you do or say something that is seen as, you know, against that, it's, if it's something that's aggressively racist or aggressively sexist or aggressively transphobic or something, the vast majority of the population thinks that is wrong. So these big companies are going to do and say what protects their bottom line. It's hilarious how it's been spun into the progressives are canceling you rather than money is trying to do what makes more and more money. So I want to jump into one of my absolute favorite coming of age ideas, let's say, that 5 or 10 years ago might have been considered radical extreme. But now, as more Americans have kind of woken up, I hate to say use that terminology, but recognized the disastrous future that we have laid for ourselves, the 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights. Alan, you are one of the primary authors of this. I'm reading over from a piece at Common Dreams by Alan Minsky and Harvey K. themselves. The time has come for progressives to rescue and renew American democracy. Why now is the exact right time to advance and fight for a 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights? Now, you've touched on FDR's first Economic Bill of Rights a little bit. Could you give us a little bit of historical context as to why that made such a big difference in the time and why this is the time for a second version?
Well, actually, Roosevelt proposed it. And, you know, the United States political trajectory after World War II, by the way, was quite in contrast to England. Of course, the impact of the war was much greater on the UK directly than it was on the United States. But you actually had the election of a Labour government that was highly transformative of British society. However, you know, the New Deal programs, when you look at, okay, capitalist societies, and one of the problems with Marxism, and I'm happy to debate this with Marxists, I have a you know, friendly attitude toward Marxists, but they seem to get one thing glaringly wrong, which is that they don't, Marx doesn't anticipate Keynes. And you know who anticipated Keynes was FDR. The New Deal programs in the 1930s and 40s actually came into existence. He was sort of like an ad hoc creation of Keynesian policies. John Maynard Keynes did not write his general theory and publish it until 1936, after the New Deal was already getting put in place. So the idea that democracies and democratic societies could use government to create a huge government sphere to reallocate wealth within a capitalist society is not anticipated by Marx. What follows then with the United States winning the World War II effectively and having a global empire and then bringing these policies around the world, you created the most prosperous, broadly middle-class societies in human history off of this template. Now, Roosevelt, at the end of his administration, at the end of his life, he of course didn't know he was going to die, though he knew he wasn't well, his final State of the Union address, he introduces a second Bill of Rights, an economic Bill of Rights. The ideas were hugely popular. However, in 1946, after he died and Harry Truman was president, the Republicans won control of Congress, one of the few times since Roosevelt. If you look from 1933 to 1994, there are only 4 years where the Republicans control the House of Representatives, and they are in the 10 years after the end of World War II. And so this rise of electoral success for the Republican Party was able to block the implementation, full implementation. Harry Truman did pick up a good portion of these and try to bring universal single-payer health care to the United States of America, but it was blocked by Republicans in Congress. It's the closest we've ever come to that, actually. Okay, mm-hmm. So nonetheless, New Deal politics were the dominant politics in America all the way through to Ronald Reagan. And the Democratic Party stood for them en masse until the rise of Bill Clinton. And so in 1994, the Tea Party, rather the Newt Gingrich revolt against the Democratic Party in the House, won control for the Republicans. And you can see that for the Democratic Party, it controlled the House for like 58 out of 62 years, basically with a social democratic set of policies that it advocated for. The Republicans were pushing against it throughout this period, of course. And then from 94 to the present, I think the Republicans will have controlled the House 22 out of 30 years. So you can see the Democratic Party is simply a failure, right? A failure when it is not pursuing these policies. And the 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights is an even stronger articulation of coming to America, a fully fledged vision of what Roosevelt wanted for America's economy. It produced the most prosperous economy in American history coming out of the New Deal, out of the victory in World War II for 25 years. And if we implement this as a template for an economic and social reorganization of American society, I believe we will once again be far and away the most prosperous country in the world. But unlike now, it will not be a country of massive wealth inequality. It'll be a country of a very broadly prosperous middle-class society. And it's a society that I think most Americans want, whether they're in small towns, rural America, suburbia, or in the heart of population centers.
And we have a push in the state of Wisconsin. Wisconsin Assemblywomen Christina Shelton as well as Francesca Hong have both gotten behind this idea. We know it's popular. I want to quote the article, progressive writer and activist Henry Damaris Lloyd, who wrote 120 years ago, quote, "The price of liberty is something more than eternal vigilance. There must also be eternal advance. We can save the rights we have inherited from our fathers only by winning new ones to bequeath our children." I think this is that's kind of fundamentally core to at least my vision of a progressive ideology, is that you can never sit on your laurels, right? There is always room to advance, always room to improve society. I mean, by definition, progressivism, progress, right? Mm-hmm. We are trying to continually improve rather than, conserve or maintain. A lot of people might argue regress, which we are seeing at the national level right now. But, you know, that's a conversation for a different day.
And you Wisconsinites have earned the right to preach progressivism because, of course, one of the leading lights in the history of progressivism in the country was Bob La Follette from Wisconsin.
Fighting Bob. Well, yeah. Our state motto is forward. I don't know if you knew that, Alan, but we have a very rich history of progressivism in the state. Milwaukee Sewer Socialists. It goes back years and years and years. So we're hoping to reclaim that. So I want to jump into the Second Bill of Rights, which would establish all Americans have a right to, one, a useful job that pays a living wage, two, a voice in the workplace through a union and collective bargaining, three, comprehensive quality health care, four, complete cost-free public education and access to broadband internet, five, decent, safe, affordable housing, six, a clean environment and a healthy planet, seven, a meaningful endowment of resources at birth and a secure retirement, eight, sound banking and financial services, nine, an equitable and economically fair justice system, and 10, recreation and participation in civic and democratic life. Starting from the top, Alan, a useful job that pays a living wage. This has been hotly contested for years and years and years as minimum wage conversations has grown to the forefront of American politics. Jump in.
Okay, let's put the minimum wage to the side. Of course, it's a fight we have to fight now because that's where the ball is on the playing field. But here's where we want it to be. Mm-hmm. Go out and ask the American people. Person, an adult, works a job 35 to 40 hours a week, 5 days a week. Should that job, whatever it is, as long as the private sector or the public sector has deemed that that job should exist and a person does it, should that person receive a living wage for it?
100%. Jobs shouldn't exist if a full-time employee is not worthy of surviving on the wage for it, then the job has no business existing.
Right. And by the way, and progressives, you know, for kids who are, you know, have lemonade stands and stuff like that, that's the right wing argument against that thing that like libertarians always bring up. To hell with that. That is nonsense. We're talking about, you know, people who have to fend for themselves. We can understand who they are. And everybody will agree with the fundamental question that if they are doing a 35 to 40 hour a week job and they are not even the question whether they're the head of household, they are simply an adult doing that job, you know, 16 and older, they should get a living wage for doing a job of 35 to 40 hours a week. It'll be supported universally when it's framed that way. And the way we establish it is by setting up a Okay, I want to say one other thing about what that does, because it goes back to the poverty question I talked earlier. When people talk about the success of the American economy, and then they point to the success of the Chinese economy, think about lifting 40, 50, 60 million people out of poverty, providing them a middle-class security. That is GDP growth. That's what China, by the way, has had over these past
Which has never been done before in the history of humanity, bringing that many people out of poverty.
Yeah, absolutely. And America is the only, sorry about the ring, America is the only of the wealthy countries that even has the wealth of poor people, as it were, that's a terrible expression, to lift out of poverty and therefore lift up the GDP of the country through policies like this. But everybody who works should get a
little
bit.
I got to cut you off. We'll be right back.
0.7 WMDX.
Welcome back, party people. This is Dueling Tangents with Luke and Brian. And because you are lucky on a Friday, Will and Evan and my good friend Alan Minsky here to talk about the 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights. Alan, we are jumping right into number two now. A voice in the workplace through a union and collective bargaining should be established. Why?
Oh, well, look, we're not proposing a radical transformation of the U.S. constitutional system. We're embracing it. We're trying to achieve change within that. We think that's what the American people want. Obviously, America's grown to be a, for so much of the population, successful, wealthy society in the system. There's no appetite to move outside of it. Look, contracts are central to our constitutional system, and labor unions are a way that, that workers have power through contractual arrangements inside the place they spend more time than anything except maybe sleeping in their life, which is at their workplace. Absolutely essential. They have democratic rights within the workplace, and they don't get exploited. It's the primary way in our society that we don't get exploited.
And it upholds the standard of living for all workers, not just those who are in that union. It gives you negotiating power. It gives you, it's so much easier to stand with your fellow workers and say, we are doing X, which is worth Y, either provide that or we all leave, than it is for one individual to say, well, I'm sick of being ripped off. What can you do to change that? So let's jump into number three, Alan. And I think this is something that will really resonate. We talked earlier about how a lot of these policies are incredibly popular, even in small, conservative, potentially rural areas in the state. And I provided an example of Wisconsin that showed that comprehensive quality healthcare. We have seen programs like this work in other first world industrialized nations. Why is the United States exempt from this? Why can't we have this too?
It's an insanity. By the way, that is an example of where Harvey and I have decided to add another phrase. We should say, comprehensive health care is a human right, free at the point of service, like it is in many of the other countries around the world, which have better outcomes for health results and their amount of the GDP. In the United States, it's 18% of GDP, and no other country in the world is it above 10. And the countries, the other, again, prosperous industrial technological democracies around the world have much better health outcomes. They have
majority of that is administrative costs as well.
Right. And of course, there's a lot of exploitation going on with the pharmaceutical companies and everything else related to the healthcare system. But again, the way to counter that is to have a single payer universal system negotiating down prices. Mm-hmm. So that's why they're so much cheaper in all these other countries. And so
it kind of comes back to unionization as well, doesn't it? In the sense that 350 American citizens standing together have a lot more bargaining power than each individual with their private health insurance provider, right?
Absolutely. It's massively deflationary, and we have more than enough work to do in society. Yes, we would no longer have the health insurance industry, which is a wholly parasitic industry, and we have some people who'd be looking for new jobs. Of course, many of the people would move into the administration of the government program of single-payer universal health care. But again, this is non-utopian. This exists everywhere else with better outcomes. People save money. They're better off because of it, both in terms of their health and in terms of their families' budgets.
And I want to touch on the reason this is something that my friends and I discuss all the time. Obviously, they're a lot younger and not as necessarily well-versed with the system is health insurance providers are essentially taking their cut off the top, right? Which is why it's more expensive in the United States than it is in some of these other first world countries. If the government were to be the quote unquote health insurance provider, they are not profit driven. They can give you the product, which in this case is healthcare, at the actual cost of the healthcare rather than needing to upcharge you to make their cut off the top.
You have no in-system, out-of-system doctors. You choose the doctors that you want. They're all cut through the same coverage, and it's all free at the point of service. I mean, it's humane. Anything else is inhumane, and we have a very, very inhumane system in the United States of America.
It's quite literally revolutionary. This would change the entire structure of American healthcare and take us from, as you said earlier, we have higher costs and lower results than basically every other first world nation on the planet, despite being the wealthiest country in the world.
On to number four.
On to number four, complete cost-free education and access to broadband internet. Broadband internet, I think, so important, and so glad you included that, particularly for rural America.
Yeah, and likewise, of course, this is public education. It should go back to being tuition-free, and it even should be made sure to be cost-free. And of course, this would eliminate the debt loads and debt peonage that people are now experiencing because of student loan debts. And of course, it will make higher education. We, by the way, one of the great assets the United States has, above and beyond any other country in the world, is we have the vast majority of the world's university intellectual infrastructure. I mean, there is nothing, no country in the world even comes close to having these massive land-grant colleges and universities in every state, often two per state. And then there's a whole network of incredible, community colleges as well as private colleges. No country even comes close. And the United States has to make these available to the welfare of the general population. And right now, our system is not even seeing the slight deterioration of our universities. You've been at some colleges close in recent years. But again, it isn't really working to the benefit of the general public and society as a whole in the way that it should.
Mm-hmm. And when you invest in your citizens, you're generating future tax revenue. You're generating better, well-versed employees that are capable of producing better society for everyone else around them. It seems like a no-brainer that you would want to invest in your own people, but maybe that's why we're different.
Yeah, and there's a lot that's transpiring right now in this Americans' economy where people load their jobs and they end up in dead-end jobs. They have to overwork. And I think the highlight and lift up higher education and also lift up vocational education, too, which PDA fully supports the expansion of, is to really, again, create a social structure. And you see this in these other prosperous countries where everybody approaches their lives with a sense that the society views them with dignity. And I don't know that that is the case in our highly, highly competitive, financialized, individualistic economy that we have in America now.
Mm-hmm. Let's jump to number five, decent, safe, affordable housing. We're seeing this in Madison in particular. Should go without saying, right?
In Los Angeles, it is an absolute catastrophe what is going on. It is a human rights abuse of the highest order, as, of course, is the U.S. prison industrial complex. But in terms of housing, yes, it is a human right to have a domicile for protection every night in your life. Yes,
particularly
we have the wealth created. We already have the buildings created. We have so much unoccupied even office space.
Exactly, millions of homes are not being lived in. We have the ability to do this. Instead, they're being bought up by national corporations that just want to jack up the rent and know that they'll have a country of
permanent renters. And also, one of the things too, we need a sane housing policy. If you look at a lot of the other countries in the world where you don't have the endemic sort of like food desert, banking desert, poor communities and population centers, that's because they dotted their public housing around their metropolitan areas. They didn't concentrate them in poor communities. There are clear strategies by which we can have federally funded housing, which cannot create these, again, poverty deserts inside our population centers.
Mm-hmm. So, Alan, thank you so much for being here today. I don't want to act like I might have did this on purpose, but maybe I'm going to force you to come back again so we can cover the last five points of the Economic Bill of Rights, because I think each one is more important than the last.
I love them. Thank you so much. It's been great to be with you, William. Great to be with you, Evan. Great to be on Devil's Radio. And everybody, check out PDA at pdamerica.org.
PDAmerica.org. I was going to say, give me a quick shout out, Alan. Where can we find you?
There we go. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks so much for being here, Alan. This was Dueling Tangents with Luke and Brian. And because you were lucky to join us on a wonderful Friday afternoon, Will, Evan, and Alan, take it easy, party people. Have a great weekend. We'll see you Monday.
Take care, my friends.